We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we're recording, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation.
This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
You package it up as I want to look a certain way. And to some degree, I still suffer from, you know, that image dysmorphia. When you start to see your body as something powerful rather than just an aesthetic being and the things that it can do, it starts to change.
Alicia Portelli is an indoor cycle coach, mum, and performer. Her dream was to be a professional entertainer, training as a singer, dancer, and actor, but that dream was left behind as she battled an eating disorder throughout her teenage years. 13 years later, after a divorce and a decade spent working in retail, Alicia reclaimed her dream, embracing a total career change and becoming an indoor cycle coach, what she calls her stage. Let me tell you, after this episode, you really need to head to Instagram and see videos of Alicia instructing. You'll understand that she was just completely born for this. And I love stories that showcase how, despite our challenges and the twists and turns that life leads us on, we can always find our way back to ourselves. Let's get into the chat. On this podcast, we discuss the learnings of life with extraordinary and everyday people, because every human being has a story and every human being knows what it means to be alive. I'm Georgia May and this is Life Chats. Thanks so much, Alicia, for joining us. Welcome to Life Chats.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
So can you give us a bit of a mission statement? I'd love for people listening to know who you are and what it is that you do.
Okay, so my goal as a trainer when I very first started was touch, move, and inspire. My biggest dream was to show women, especially mothers, that life didn't stop when you had children and that you could still focus on yourself. And I'm all about living big and dreaming big and chasing the things that light you up. I think nowadays in this day and age, we're sort of told that we must earn a certain amount of money, we must work a certain amount of hours, but at what point do we actually live our passion and do we fulfill some of the things that we truly love? And maybe if being a mother lights you up, amazing, you know, go for it. But I genuinely believe there's so much more to the just that one-sided role. So my goal is to show, I mean, all walks of life, but people that they can be more than they think they can be.
I love that. Give us a little bit of an insight into how you came upon that mission statement. Like growing up, did you always have a dream or were you all about female empowerment or did you have a dream of being a mom? Like what was your experience like as a child?
Okay, really interesting. I started as a dancer. That was my big goal, my big dream. I always tell this story, but I have this very distinct memory at 7 years old, coming home from swimming lessons, and I had a surprise birthday party, and I remember having a wish chip that was folded. Anyway, every time I made a wish on a chip, I wished to be a famous performer, entertainer, and my big dream was to travel around the world and dance on stage. And I guess I'm kind of doing that now on a bike, but I've always trained with people that have sought greatness in everything that they do. So, you know, my father is one of those people, my dance teacher, Robin Dixon, who's no longer Robin Dixon, my cycle coach, Akin as well, just all people that really aspire to be above the norm. I guess my favorite quote is inspired by the fear of being average. And so I guess being a mother wasn't necessarily a dream of mine. Did I want to be a mom? Of course. I've always loved children. I genuinely loved entertaining kids when I was working as a professional entertainer. It was always fun. I have that energy and I really loved connecting with innocence and youth and people that really appreciated it. I guess you can say as I've matured, I've wanted to share that with all ages. So yeah.
I'm interested, you said something that you used to dream about being a famous performer. What about that experience was alluring to you? Like, what did you get out of performing?
I guess when you get on stage, one of the things that's never left me was my dance teacher, Robin, used to say, when you perform, you don't perform for the front row. You must touch the person in the back corner with your energy. And I guess when you're on stage, it's an extension of expression of yourself. And so there's something really beautiful being able to move, express, and feel and light somebody else up. And I guess for me, energy is such a powerful thing that being able to use that to touch, move, and inspire others is a really beautiful thing. So for me, I guess it's being able to do what I love and share that with people and light them up in a different way. And performing is about bringing joy to somebody, is about making them smile, is about changing their energy or enabling them to come along the journey with you. So that's why I really try to incorporate that in everything that I do. So when I teach, you know, there is an element of motivation. There is an element of being a tough nut, but there's also that element of how do I make you smile? How do I make you feel joy whilst you're enduring maybe a little bit of pain or a little bit of struggle? So it's not always just one-sided, like this is hard, this sucks. Mm. It's like, okay, this is tough, but I want to bring the joy and the fun to it as well.
Something that you said before is that you were around people who had this mindset about being, you know, being great and being greater than average. Your dad, you mentioned. Where do you think that comes from? Do you think that's like a trained sort of mindset, or do you think people are born more optimistic and more ambitious than others? And in your own experience, I guess, what has that been like?
Yeah, good question. I guess it depends on how you've been raised. Michael Jackson is my other idol. And when you think about all the people that I look up to, they're all driven in their categories. So Michael wanted to revolutionize the way music videos were done. That, you know, he studied all the greats in the dance field, and his music was always evolving and always one step ahead of the competition. My dance teacher instilled in us passion, dedication. You know, I have this distinct memory, one dance class that we did or performance practice, and she held us back and we just repeated the same move again and again until she could feel the energy and the passion through our hands and our fingers. And my father is a very similar person who's very methodic in what he does. And I guess it's always moving the goalposts. And in that, it's a blessing and a curse, because if you're constantly moving the goalposts, yes, you're always aiming higher. But at the same point, the thing that I do sometimes struggle with is I'm never satisfied where I'm at, or I fail to celebrate the small wins along the moment. So I'm personally really working on that. And my coach on the bike is a very similar character. I'll never forget listening to a podcast he did once before. His name is Akin. He's in New York. And he basically said that there is no top. It's ever evolving. You must continue to evolve. You must continue to learn to stay ahead of the game. And if you're not doing that, then you're only there for a fleeting second, because everybody will catch up. So I guess there's a part of me that I don't want to say the best, because to be the best is subjective, but to be the best version of myself is to continually evolve, be more, learn more, do more. One of my sayings in class is the second that you stop learning, you start dying. And that sounds very morbid, but it's my genuine belief that the second that you think you've got it all together and you don't have any more to do, like, it's kind of like reaching a pinnacle. Like, what's on the other side of that? It's a downhill descent. So I never want to think that I'm there. It's always got to keep evolving and growing. And it doesn't have to. It's not about being better than anybody else. It's just about doing the best that I can, because I have a very big love of celebrating others as well. I want to see my peers and people around me win constantly, because it's, I guess, raised as a dancer, we were always trained to compete in dance at Stedfords. And I find that environment incredibly toxic. So as long as I'm doing my best and living my purpose, I love seeing that about other people as well. And I love seeing others win. So I'm a big advocate in championing my peers, as well as going after what I want. And if I'm elevating the game and somebody else is elevating the game, then we're constantly elevating each other. And that's the only way to win, in my opinion.
Totally. Something you just mentioned is, yeah, that can be quite a toxic environment. Growing up in that as a teen, what was your experience like competitively dancing?
So my father loves to win. So I guess that was instilled in me. I remember him not bribing us, but if we won something, we would get something. So I guess that's a lot of where my mindset comes. When you work really hard for something, then you reap the benefits. But I guess girls can be a bunch of bitches, let's be really frank. And I do remember feeling like an outcast and bullied. And I guess I dealt with an eating disorder from about the age of 12. And I have, I don't want to say successfully kicked it in the ass. I've obviously curbed the habits until about age 38. But of course, you're always of that mindset. It's 28 years of feeling like that. And I don't want to say that I started down that path because of other people, because my issues have a lot to do with rejection control. I genuinely believe that most eating disorders, as well as being a chemical imbalance, are actually stemmed from us not wanting to feel certain things. And I guess, I mean, experiencing rejection as a teen, I remember sometimes walking into different spaces and not being accepted in the way that I wanted to, or not necessarily being the popular one in the room. And of course, or the wiser maybe, depending on how you want to see it. I come to learn that the brighter your light, the more it shines on other people's shadows. So looking back now, when you have something special or you have a gift, you have a talent, people are either going to love you for it or they're going to be envious or they're not going to like you for it.
That's really hard to understand when you're a teenager though, isn't it? Like you kind of don't have that psychological understanding yet of why people behave the way that they do or why you have certain behaviors. I guess at what point in your eating disorder, but also in your life, did you start to become aware of like why you might be turning to some behaviors or why you might have certain habits?
I guess like when you start out on that journey, it really is all about you package it up as I want to look a certain way. And to some degree, I still suffer from that image dysmorphia. But it wasn't until through my healing journey, because I was hospitalized during my teens and I never really liked counselors and psychologists. And I guess there's a solid part of me that this is actually really sad to admit, but at the height of my illness around sort of 16, 17, 18, I wanted to die. I wanted to be on the cover of magazines at 24, being painfully thin. There were actually a set of twins that did achieve that, which is where the inspo came from. And that's a really shitty thing to acknowledge. But you've got to want to be ready to let go of it. And I guess my journey up until my 30s, there was a part of me that wanted to be free from it, but there wasn't a part of me that was ready to be completely done with it. And there were pockets, like when I was pregnant, I managed to stop. And then later on down the track, like those habits re-picked back up again. I read a book, and I highly recommend this to any survivor, anybody going through it, or even people standing on the sidelines watching a loved one go through this. The book is called Eating in the Light of the Moon. You can't buy it in stores. You need to buy it on Amazon. I have no affiliation. I don't get any kickbacks. But it was the first book that I read that truly opened my eyes. And it felt like someone was sitting there across from me telling me how I felt. And basically this book starts off every chapter with a fable, and then she goes into the lesson. And there was a solid part in that that helped me understand that women were meant to feel. We're round, we have cycles, we go up and down with our periods and things like that, whereas men are quite linear, black and white. So of course, as someone that's bulimic and anorexic, we aspire to be a very straight up and down, black and white figure that doesn't feel. And I guess the body shape ends up being that way. Whereas, you know, round is curvaceous, is feminine, is beautiful, feminine is feeling. But that with that means there's highs and there's lows. And I guess some of the lessons within this book really opened my eyes. One of the things she asks you to do is before you go to binge, or maybe before you go to throw up or try to think about abstaining, think about the situations that's put you in that position. And I really started to ascertain the behaviors behind the whys. that's where I really worked out about the control. I worked out about the rejection. I then started to make peace with it. And then, of course, there were other tidbits in the book about recovery, and I'm very all or nothing. So I used to see recovery as something like, oh, cool, you just quit vomiting one day and that's it. You just quit binging and that's it. No, unfortunately, it's not that easy. And with every attempt to heal, there will be a setback. So imagine you're, okay, this is the best way to describe it. Imagine you're trying to cross a rapid river. Now, you're not going to know how to completely navigate that. So you're going to jump on the log, you're going to try to go across, you're going to fall off pretty early on. So then you're going to swim back to shore. Then you're going to assess it again and you're going to attempt it again. And this time you might get a little bit further in that journey and you might fall off again. And so you swim back to shore, you square yourself up, you get ready to do it again. And it can take as many attempts as you need. But the lesson is in the failing, is in the falling. And so from there on in, and I teach this a lot in my classes, it's not necessarily about the execution to perfection. It truly is in the learning. So we try, we fail, we learn, we repeat, and we keep doing that until we win.
It can be challenging, especially if you've grown up with the mindset of like winning is everything and, you know, a bit of a perfectionistic tendencies. It's like if you fail, then that's the be all and end all. But I think it's so important to normalize for people who are going through this journey that like there is no amount of times, that's too many times to fail. You just try again and again and again until you heal.
Yeah. And I mean, you've got to want to be ready to let it go as well, because I think I also saw my eating disorder as a massive part of my identity. You know, like I couldn't hang around people, or I couldn't go out with people to dinner because I was so invested in controlling everything that like it controlled my life, even though I thought I controlled it and was in control. I mean, that's why I started doing drugs as well, because, and smoking. I wanted to always feel, I loved the feeling of being starved, and it's such a chaotic feeling. But yeah, it was all around that. So
it must be hard to navigate when you're working in an industry where like fit bodies and bodies that look a certain way are really celebrated. Of course, that's changing a little bit, but particularly the generation that you grew up in, it was like how you look, the skinnier you are, the better, the higher your sense of self-worth. So I guess, how do you navigate that now, all these years later, working in the fitness industry?
Yeah, I don't necessarily feel the pressure to look a certain way nowadays in terms of the atmosphere and the environments that I find myself in. Yep. The pressure for me obviously comes from within, and obviously my years of experience of dealing with what I have. I guess back when I was a teenager, you know, our role models were like Kate Moss, Victoria Beckham, Ginger Spice, when they were all bulimic, anorexic, starving themselves. And that really was what was on the cover of all the magazines. For those of you listeners, we didn't have the internet and social media. It was magazine covers. How crazy is that to think about, right? And so nowadays, I guess I really reconciled with the fact early on that my legs were never going to look like ballet dancer legs. Like I've got European blood in me. I've always had bigger legs. And so I'm never going to have the thigh gap. So when I started weight training, I found a sense of empowerment in how my body looked, in how I could perform. Also the strength that my mindset took and my strength of character. So even that was a huge journey. And at that point, I wasn't into spin because spin made your legs big.
Right.
Also, we all think I've got crazy quads, but I think that they're great. Yep. But I guess when you start to see your body as something powerful rather than just an aesthetic being and the things that it can do, it starts to change. Another really great quote that I heard once was, at your leanest, you're not going to be your fittest, but at your fittest, you're not going to be your leanest. And it's a really powerful statement to think about, because when you're a high-performing athlete, you're not necessarily going to look like a certain body type. Yeah, you're going to need probably a little bit more fat, or you're going to be a little bit bulkier to be able to lift heavy, to be able to run fast, to be able to perform. But to think about being lean or skinny or aesthetically pleasing like a model, that's not really a sports body. So again, that was another tip that really helped me push past those moments of, well, my body's able to do these incredible things that an older version couldn't. And I've experienced that over the years where I've looked really lean, I've looked really great. People have commented how great I look, but my energy is shit.
That's so true.
Like I really struggle. And then of course I get frustrated because I'm not the athlete I want to be. So then I finally become that. And then I'm like, oh, but now I'm fat. So it's this conundrum.
Such a mind spin, because I feel like we've been conditioned. That happens. I speak to so many friends and even myself where people will come and say, you look amazing. And in my head, I'm thinking like, I've been really sick or really stressed or, you know, right? I haven't been eating or sleeping and you're celebrating me for that. I feel like we just need to blanket statement, stop commenting on how people look. Amen. In regards to their weight. Like say you look glowing, you look happy, you look aligned. I feel right? like, yeah, those comments about you look good because you're leaner is not necessarily the healthiest thing to be saying to people.
Totally. And it comes from an unhealed place of themselves as well. For me, it's actually one of the most damaging things to hear. And I, particularly coming to Asia, I've actually had quite a few comments that the first time I visited to now, that I'd lost a lot of weight and that I was chunky.
Wow.
And I can't tell you. And because I guess culturally here, they can be quite black and white. Love them. Please don't get me wrong. Love my people. But it is quite tough to hear, especially when you think, I mean, I obviously knew that I wasn't looking my absolute best back then, but at the same point, like I was doing incredible things and I'm doing great things now. And but I'm training differently, I'm eating differently, I'm in a different space, and there's other things going on. So sometimes you're 100% right. Like I'm not telling you how you look. Like I never get into a room and talk about weight, talk about looks. For me, it's all about performance and what you can do. And I genuinely believe in my heart of hearts that if you look after yourself, if you move, if you eat well, if you sleep well, if you drink the right amount of water, which that was a nice little reminder for myself. You do glow. And really? It's not your body that people look at. It's actually like the energy that comes out from your face, your smile, you know, the clearness in your eyes, your mood. You know, that's what people want to be around. Like they don't necessarily give a fuck if you've got like a six pack and your bum sticking out. Like what does that even matter, you know, for 5 seconds?
A quick break from the episode to speak about our reviews. Now, Life Chats has recently hit over 30,000 listens, which is honestly incredible. So exciting. But we only have 18 reviews on Apple Podcasts, which is a bit sad. So it would mean the world if you could just take 1 minute out of your day to leave a written review for us, either on Apple or Spotify. There is truly so much time and care and effort that goes into these episodes. I research, edit, host, distribute, do everything all by myself. And I don't make any money from this show. I do it because the stories deserve to be heard and I truly love it. So if you could do that review, that would mean the world. You can also follow us on Instagram and TikTok at Life Chats Podcast if you don't already. The goal is to build a bigger community so I can continue producing these inspiring conversations. Thanks so much for being here. Back to the episode. So how do you go from being someone who's like navigating an eating disorder, turning to drugs, very hyper-focused on how you look to like anyone that's listening to this episode needs to go and look at your Instagram, because some of the videos I showed my boyfriend, we watched one video like 12 times. I was like, look at this woman. She's so strong and powerful. Like what is that journey? Because I heard online that, you know, you worked in retail for over a decade. You went to a class or you went to a gym. You didn't even want to set foot on a bike. And now you're in Singapore teaching. Like, how does that happen?
It's actually a really interesting story. So if you don't mind going back.
Go for it.
I guess as a teenager, my big dream was to be a dancer and a performer. And then, of course, once I turned to drugs, that dream kind of subsided. And you know, we do get lost as teenagers. And I started working in the hospitality industry. And that's when I met my now ex-husband, who became like wonderful human, but he became my self-esteem. And I genuinely, again, he's a great human. I don't like not rubbishing him. But when someone so good looking finally sees you and acknowledges you, you all of a sudden find a sense of, oh, wow, I must be okay. I must be important. And he was really my biggest supporter for a long time when people used to rubbish me, put me down. I was like classed as like, I was the garbage of the lot. And so he was like, no, she's amazing. And so, of course, through that, it was him that actually said, you should go to the gym if you want to look after yourself, lose weight. And that's when I started running. And I hated running, I would get on a treadmill and I would be on there for maybe 20 minutes and I would walk for five, run for one. That was as best as you got. And then in the end, I became obsessed with running and I ran competitively in those like city races that we used to do. And then from there, I found boxing and I quite enjoyed CrossFit for a short period of time. And then, of course, I then transitioned into weights, which I'll never forget picking up weights for the first time and doing a session. And I was such a cardio queen. Like, unless I was killing myself, sweating, burpees, you name it, I wasn't satisfied. And so I remember picking up weights and not sweating. And I got to the end of the session and I cried. And I was on a 12-week program. And I remember saying to the coach, I was like, is this actually going to do anything for me? Anyway, she kind of giggled and laughed and she's like, wait and see. And so, of course, I kept it up and it wasn't necessarily just the physical changes that really excited me, but it was the mental. Anyway, I was working in retail at that point and I used to train 9-10 times a week. Like I was obsessed. I would get up super early. I would go to work and sometimes I would go back to the gym in the evening and it really became, some people would say, an unhealthy obsession, but to me, it was just what I loved doing. And I, as someone that moved their entire life, movement is a way of expression for myself. It was a way for me to put earphones in and hide from the world, but listen to music. And as a child, I would do the same thing. I would lock myself in my room and listen to Michael Jackson for hours on end and dance. So I guess now that I think about it, the parallels are very similar. You put AirPods in, you get into your own headspace, and I may not be I do dance in between sets. People probably think I'm really strange in the gym. Anyway, I was working at a couple of various athletic brands. So I worked with Adidas, I worked with Lana Jane, I worked with Lululemon, I worked with Lonsdale. And it was at Lululemon. I genuinely believe that the universe moves you into positions to set you up for your next step. And I, at that point in my life, I was terrible, terrible at hearing when the universe was trying to steer me into a direction, and so much so that I would get fired or I, you know, it would make me really uncomfortable for me to react. And so, of course, I was demoted at Lululemon, and that's when I was like, I need to finish off my certs. And so one of the ambassadors at Lululemon owned a cycle studio, and we as a team used to go and frequent the studio, but I never did. I was like, I hate spin. I thought it was weird. I used to see the girls come out and I was like, their legs are big. Like, why would you want that? I always wanted to fit into size 2, size 4 Lululemon tights. And all the yoga girls look so good. So I was like, that's what I want to be. Anyway, he said to me, he's like, you know, you really should consider being a spin instructor. I think you'd be awesome. And I will never forget the first time he asked me, I went, fuck off. In the middle of Lululemon while I was in the fits area. And he was, I guess, a little taken back. But of course, it was a persistent, like, 4 months, you should think about it. And it wasn't until I was demoted at Lululemon. My mortgage was $700 a week. I was probably earning $500. So you do the math, doesn't take a stupid person to realize I'm hemorrhaging. I'm a single mom with 2 children, earning less. So I'm like eating into all of my savings. So of course, when he's like 2 classes, $120, it's like, yes, I'll get on a bike. And so, of course, I'll never forget, there was the first class of his that I took. He like pointed at me, he goes, put some resistance on. And I'm literally free spinning on this bike with nothing on there, looking completely unimpressed by, you know, my environment. Everybody around me is having a great time. I'm like, shoot me. Like, what is this? And so, of course, I then take the job because I'm financially destitute. And I'll never forget getting on. I was like, this is like being on stage. Now, I started out as a performance cycles coach. So we had metrics, we had a screen, there were elements of rhythm, but not really what I do now. It wasn't a rhythm focused class. And I knew about Soul Cycle, but I had never seen a class. I'd never attended it. I just knew that it was huge in the States. And so, of course, a client had come in, he is a friend now, but had come into one of my classes and he basically was like, I'm opening a rhythm studio. I would love for you to audition for me. And so, of course, my journey started there. I still have my audition video on my Instagram if you've got time. It's horrendous, but it's very, very funny to watch. And, of course, I started, and again, it's like encompassing all the things that I love: music, dance, motivating people, inspiring people. And so I guess throughout that training, I was always inspired about doing the hardest things that I could. It was never about being like fun or entertaining people. Like in that essence, it was always like, how do I push the boundaries and have fun while doing it? And so I guess like that's where it all started. And if you were to tell me 7 years ago that I would open my own cycle studio, close my own cycle studio within a short amount of time, and then teach all over the world, I probably would have said you were fucking crazy. But here I am. So yes. And I move countries.
Exactly. I wanted to ask about that. Like, how did the move to Singapore come about?
Yeah. So I guess one of the best things that I did in lockdown was, while everybody was going gangbusters and hustling of getting online profiles and things happening, I kind of reclused. I went into my shell a little bit. I was super tired from teaching so much. And as the world slowed down, so did I. And it was a meeting with Lululemon. I was an ambassador at that point. And I have no idea what came over me, because I didn't want to do this at all. But I literally said to them, I'm like, maybe I'll open my own cycle studio. For the love of God, I have no idea where that came from, but I genuinely believe that sometimes the universe will put words into your mouth and send it out there. And so, of course, I'd put it out there. It was like a magical spell. And then one day I decided that I'm actually going to do this. I was approached by a couple of clients and they were like, we'd love to invest in you. We'd love to see where you can take this. And so I started dreaming. And in the end, I ended up doing it on my own. So that's kind of where that started. And it really gave me a platform of being able to do what I loved my way. One of the things that I'm not great at is conforming. I'm a little rebellious in that aspect. And I guess that's been nurtured from me as a child. Totally. To really think outside the box, you know, color outside the lines, be bigger than what you think you can be. And of course, I don't really like authority.
You and me both.
Yeah. Okay, good.
I literally have this term that I don't know if I've come up with it or if I've read it somewhere, but I call myself psychologically unemployable. Like, I cannot be told what to do. It's not good.
I like this. No, it's good. It's good. Well, I mean, that's where entrepreneurs are. They start, like, they think outside the box. And I think sometimes we're really confined by societal ideals. And yes, whilst that's important, like, legends rarely are someone that fall within the lines. Legends are people that dare to be great, dare to be different, that make an impact because they're like nobody else. So I guess I see and identify with that, which is why I tell people that I fucking hate Taylor Swift. You know, I don't really have too much of an opinion on her, but the more I say it, the more arc that I get. And it works for me. If you like Taylor, I do apologize, but I fucking hate Taylor Swift. Most people don't love Michael either, so it's all good. But getting back to the question, I guess, Jam really gave me a platform to lean into who I was even more so and learn more about myself as a coach and really evolve my style. And I created a brand and I had an incredible group of writers who I call the Jam Fab. If you're listening, I fucking love you guys and miss you. I was so proud of what we did and what we achieved. And watching all of those videos, I guess the one thing that I really want, aside from wanting to be the best version of myself as I could as a coach, was to really share my heart and passion of my craft. And I can honestly say that I did that with my team. You can see it in the way they rode. You can see it in the way we came together and we trained. I'm both proud. And I guess, like, an old retail manager once said to me that not everything is designed to last and that it's beautiful as a snapshot in time. And I guess that's where Jam is. And Jam will always live on with me because it's my purpose, it's my passion. So my brand pillars are. Passion is our purpose. Individuality through alignment, change via the movement. And within those, passion is my purpose. Everything that I do is layered with passion. You know, I can be quite polarizing. You either love me or you loathe me. But passion is at the forefront of everything that I do. And I think that trumps everything. Individuality through alignment. I wanted to create a team of coaches that did it their own unique way, but through the same discipline. So obviously we all taught a class to the beat of the music, but you got to bring your unique self to the table. And as writers as well, who they were, you know, I accepted anybody that fit our culture, which was, you know, family first, support each other, growth. You know, you got to want to be challenged. I didn't accept gossiping and people being bitchy with each other. So that was a really big thing. And then change via the movement. I really wanted to change the way we trained, we moved forward about projects that we were passionate about. So at that point in time, I used to champion child sexual abuse and trafficking and things like that. Unfortunately, I don't know if you know much about that story, but the guy that ran that charity is an absolute crook. That's a whole other podcast. It was during JAM that I sort of started to get invited to go places. And every studio that I've ever been to, I've been invited to teach at. And I guess through people coming to my classes, this is where my opportunities have come. So to any fitness coach that's out there, sometimes the opportunities aren't you necessarily seeking them, but just by doing what you do. So every time you teach a class, I genuinely believe that everybody that's in that room is there for a reason, but that is your business card. And so if you want these opportunities, like these are the best moments to be seen, to deliver. Anyway, Dan, the owner of Absolute Cycle and one of the coaches, Ceiling, who came to Australia and took my class, approached me in July last year and opened the dialogue about me coming to run some workshops and really just seeing who I was. And then from there, I visited the studio and I did a residency for a month. I did 3 weeks in Singapore and a week in Bangkok. I didn't particularly want to move. I really thought the opportunity would be every quarter they would fly me in. I would do a residency. I would go. And then my big dream was to, you know, my big dream is to end up in New York. I would love to one day at some point work with Akin and work with Army. I'm now putting it out there for everyone
to hear.
Manifest
it.
Just letting you all know.
Yep. I'm coming.
But who knows what that looks like. But you know, go to Mexico, go to places like Dubai and share my heart. So I kind of thought that that would be how it would work. And when I got to Bangkok, I remember a moment being at one of the studios and I sat there and I looked around and I was like, it was like that moment that I had with Lululemon when I said I was going to open a studio. I was like, I could move countries. I could live here. And again, moving countries was never something that I aspired to do. I never really traveled. I always thought Sydney would be home. And so in that moment, I was like, I'm going to do this. And so I kind of set about to do it. And that's kind of where that evolved. And then, of course, the owners came back and created a role for me. And I'm incredibly blessed to be working alongside the team at Absolute. They're an amazing group of people. They're all super passionate and driven and wanting to go big places. And to be quite frank, it's the most successful cycle boutique, Pilates fitness boutique in Asia. I think they've got 15 studios across 3 countries. The owner, Ben, is possibly one of the most inspirational people that you can be around just because she's so driven and smart. And I really love being surrounded by that energy because it's the same sort of energy that, you know, I appreciate and aspire to be like. And her husband, Ben, is just really nurturing and beautiful. So I learn a lot from both of those two and the team. So anyway,
epic.
That was a shameless plug, wasn't it?
No, I loved it. Because we only have about 10 minutes left, something that we haven't touched on that I would love to hear you reflect on is how did becoming a mum change your life? And like amongst all this, all these self-realizations and growing and learning, you reflect on being pregnant as something that kind of pulled you out of your eating disorder, I guess. How else did it change your life?
Yeah, interesting story. I met my now ex-husband at 19. We'd moved in together within a couple of months. I think we lived together from day one almost pretty much. We had a bank account by the first month. We were engaged at 7 months. We were together for 12 years. We were almost married for 10. So again, if you told me that I would find my then what I thought life partner and have children early was a thing. It definitely wasn't what I saw for myself. But I guess when you fall in love and everything's amazing, that's what you do. I had children pretty early on. I was 24 when I fell pregnant with Chloe. Obviously, all planned. We were married for 2 years and we kind of thought that Patrick may not have been able to have babies. And one of my biggest fears were being someone that really desperately wanted to have children and have that journey being really challenging, which I see so much in other women. I really feel for them because that yearn to be a mother that should come so naturally is something so tough for some. So I really do feel for those women. But luckily for me, it was the first attempt. We kind of sort of said that we would start trying and hopefully 6 months to 2 years it would happen. Didn't quite work out that way. Literally first go. I'm not even going to tell you the story about that. That's a whole other one. But I wasn't really ready to be a mom, if I'm genuinely honest. I liked the idea, but obviously when it landed in your lap, I was like, oh God, I've got to do this. And at being 24, 25, I didn't really have friends that were mothers. I had no idea what I was doing. I was very independent. I liked to do what I wanted when I wanted. So I worked in retail. I would see friends. I would train at 8, 9, 10 at night if I wanted to. And so, of course, when Chloe came along, I obviously didn't deal well with the weight gain. I gained 30 kilos in my first pregnancy. And I guess with all new mothers, sort of in that stage, some people like to wrap themselves up in cotton wool. And I sort of took that opportunity as a chance to sort of slow down. I still worked. I was on my feet pretty much to the end of my pregnancy, but I didn't really train too much. Of course, when you have the second child, no one gives a fuck. You have a child, you've done this before, so you keep going. And I was a lot more active during Benji. That was when I was 28. I trained pretty well much up to the final days. I worked almost to the end. I was renovating a house. I still remember holding the stairs above my head. And I remember my father cracking the shits because the stairs weren't fitting in properly. And he literally threw some tools and had a fit and walked off. And I'm left standing there with both arms above my head, like shaking at one point. And I was like, just breathe, like you're trained for this, Alicia. It was, I'll never forget that moment. I mean, packaging and set, like proper renovating on top of ladders at 9 months pregnant. I put on about 15 kilos with Benji. So obviously vastly different experiences. And when I became a mum the second, I'm going to be really honest and people don't like hearing this, but I'm going to say it. I didn't love being a mom for the first 6 months. I hated it actually. Chloe was tough. She didn't sleep. And I genuinely believe she was feeding off my energy. And that was an energy of what the fuck am I doing? I want to go to the gym. I'll never forget getting back on the treadmill. And my pelvic floor was so weak that I would wet myself while running. And I just remember crying, thinking, what is going on? And I never wanted to be one of those women that went to mother's group and ate banana bread and didn't look after themselves. Like I was like, right, I've got to sort myself out. And I wanted to get myself back to a place. And the only toxic thing around me at that point was there were so many women that made out like they were back in their pre-baby jeans and their pre-baby bodies within 3 months. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like I'm so sleep deprived. I can't even think at 12 weeks. And so that was probably the worst part about it. But it took me 9 months to put on 30 kilos. It took me 9 months to take that 30 kilos off. And I was in a great place at that point. And it was probably around the 6 month mark that I finally looked at my daughter and was like, oh, I love you. And of course I found her beautiful. But for me, that newborn stage was a massive slap in the face.
Important to normalize that.
Yeah. Look, it's really important to talk about because, and I used to say this to people, like I remember going to mother's group. I had a great mother's group actually. We were just different, but a bunch of unique people and really lovely humans that didn't judge each other. It was actually really nice. But I think we're kind of told that the baby goes in your arms and you instantly fall in love. But no one tells you that sleepless nights and you don't just wrap them and they go to sleep. You know, they're awake and they're their own unique commodity, right? So they require different things and they can't communicate. So when you're so used to being able to just talk, get things done, do what you want, all of a sudden you're now existing for somebody else. And so that was a really big shock to the system for me, that like it was no longer just about myself. It was now how I needed to be for somebody else that really relied on me. But when Benji came along, there was a different connection. I remember like touching my stomach while I was pregnant and being a lot more emotionally connected. And my son and I have a really great bond as well. But the one thing that I cooked when I had him was that, being the perfectionist that I am, I was like, well, I've done this before, so I will know how to do this now. And I set about to create the perfect baby. And in doing that, I drove myself a little bit crazy. So I actually ended up in a nurse's clinic with Benji as well, because I was so fixated on trying to get him into a routine, get him to doing things that made me look like I knew what I was doing. And of course, he's kind of like, are you kidding me? And he wasn't a bad baby at all. You know, he was far less challenging than what Chloe was, but I drove myself nuts is what I want to say. So, but it was in that point that I really started to want to stay at home with my children. And I didn't really want to be a trainer up until that point, where I decided that, I mean, my experience of wanting to do that was, I used to do these mums and bubs classes with my good friend Brielle and my trainer at that point, Jenny. And what I loved was competing with Brielle to be a better athlete. We always like pushed each other to be great. But then once we were done, I would go to the back of the pack, and I loved motivating the mothers that were struggling, that weren't as strong, to come up. So there was like two solid sides of my personality. There was that side that wanted to win, but there was also that side that wanted to see others win. And it was the motivating that I really loved. And then that's when I decided that, okay, I want to give this to other people. And so I sort of went to my ex-husband and was like, I want to be a trainer. I want to stay at home and be a stay-at-home mom with the kids. I want to work during the days, you know, at a gym and be a PT, but then I could pick the kids up and be there for them. But of course, we had a mortgage, and he was kind of like, well, you need to bring in the money that you're bringing in. So that kind of curtailed. And it wasn't until we split and that I was working in retail that, you know, the universe lined everything up. And of course, my demotion with Lululemon meant that I took on the role at Scenic Cycle as a cycle coach. I applied for a children's entertainment role. So I used to go around preschools and do fitness shows for them, which was awesome. And then I also was offered to be a trainer at a boot camp. And then, so that was 5 days a week. So I used to work pretty much like 6 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. I think at the beginning of my career, I worked 7 days a week. I used to tackle 30 odd classes a week, 7 days a week, no days off. I pretty much put myself into a very poor physical state.
I can imagine.
I lost my voice. Yeah. Broke my rib. I ended up with colitis again. So again, all these learning lessons. But yes, okay. Motherhood, I learned along the journey something that I'm going to share this. I love my mum dearly because she did everything for my sister and I, like running around. But what I saw of her was she really lost who she was as a person. She didn't really have friends. She didn't really go out and do the things that lit her up. Like my sister and I are what lit her up, you know, seeing us dance, seeing my sister was an Australasian roller skating champion. She was like fucking great as well. But I never wanted to be like my mum. I had my own dreams. I didn't want to just be Chloe and Benji's mum. I wanted to be Alicia Portelli, which was a really big turning. I'm going to share this because this is really important for me. I was Alicia Thomas until one New Year's Eve, and we had split, and that's when I decided I'm going to change my name back because I wanted a chance to do me again. Alicia Portelli up until I was married was someone that I didn't really like. I hated my surname. People used to ask me all the time, was I Italian, and I didn't want to be associated with my European descent for reasons I'm not going to go into right now. It's a whole other podcast. And I didn't really like who I was. And, you know, this is the bulimic, the drug taking, the one that people thought would never amount to anything. In my younger years, they did. But obviously, as I fell off the rails, people were like, she's a piece of trash. I remember sitting very clearly one New Year's Eve deciding that I was no longer going to be Alicia Thomas, that I was changing back to Alicia Portelli. And it was my chance to do myself again and to fall in love with me and to just rewrite who that was and get back to that same girl that lived fully and lived passionately and did the things that she loved. And I guess maybe that was the definitive point in my life. This is such a realization right now. This feels like a therapy session.
Welcome to Life Chats.
But yeah, I do love this. I didn't really pinpoint this until now, but that was a massive turning point because that's when I decided that I was going to start getting back to the old Alicia and falling in love with her and really making something of that. So I guess it's been a culmination of years. I think I would have been, what, 33, 34 at that point. I can't remember. I've got to go back and figure that out now. But I feel like there's been many ups and downs. I've wanted to find love and all of that. But I think now that I think about it, even though I've been single all that time, my biggest love is what I do. My heart is so full getting to teach. People sometimes think I'm crazy, but I just love it. I just love even the low moments when you don't feel your best. Those moments when you think, I mean, I had a week like that, I second guessed myself. I was like, am I meant to be doing this? Am I good enough for this? And the answer is yes. I'm fucking great at what I do. Not because of any physical thing. It's because I love it so much. Anyway.
Amazing. I think that's such a powerful place to close this conversation. I feel like I could talk to you for hours, honestly. We'll have to get you back on the show, but I can't end without asking you the question that I ask every single guest. You can answer in as many or as little words as you like. That question is, Alicia, what is the meaning of life?
Oh, to live passionately, to do the things that light you up and to light others up.
Where can we find you? Where can tell our audience, like, where can they book a class with you or where can they find you online? What's the best place to get in touch?
Yes. So I'm currently residing in Singapore for most of my time. So if you're ever frequenting Asia, just DM me. I'm either in Singapore or I go to Bangkok every 2 months. But this is a now shameless plug, if you want to hire me, you can always reach out, DM me for guest teaching and workshops. And to spread the love, I've just come back from KL with Hit Rebel. I have a couple of gigs lined up coming forward. So that's really exciting to share. So yeah, perfect. I don't know whether I'll be back in Australia anytime soon, but
I'll be coming to one of your classes if you are, that's for sure.
Please do. I would really love that.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Please let me know who you'd love me to chat to next. Or if you have a story of your own you'd like to share, you can connect with me directly on Instagram at Life Chats Podcast, one word. Until next time, I'm Georgia May and this is Life Chats.